morning, listeners. Welcome to this week's edition of Thursday in the Doghouse. I'm your host, Rini Premeza, the Jersey Dog Trainer. Our 30-minute program is always full of helpful information for the dog-owning community or anyone who just loves dogs. My goal is always to provide you with as much information as possible about this wonderful and intelligent species of animals so that you'll have a much better understanding of why your dogs do the things they do. Dr. Nicholas Dodman returns to the doghouse this morning for his second visit. He spoke at length with us last week about dogs that suffer from obsessive-compulsive disorders. This week, he's coming back to educate us about dogs that suffer from phobias. Dr. Dodman is a diplomate of the American College of Veterinary Behaviorists, and he's a professor, section head, and program director of the Animal Behavior Department of Clinical Sciences at Tufts Cummings School of Veterinary Medicine. Dr. Dodman is one of the world's most noted and celebrated veterinary behaviorists. Dr. Dodman has written 4 acclaimed best-selling books. His first book, The Dog Who Loved Too Much, was an unqualified success, selling more than 100,000 copies, as did his second book, The Cat Who Cried for Help. His third book, Dogs Behaving Badly, was again a bestseller. His latest book is entitled The Well-Adjusted Dog. I can tell you that his writing style is both easy and very enjoyable to read, and he illustrates many of the cases that he's worked on. And I would recommend his books to dog owners, trainers, and veterinarians. Before we talk to Dr. Dodman about phobic dogs, please let me tell you what services I offer as a professional dog trainer in the South Jersey area. Is your dog always in the doghouse? Does he greet people by jumping all over them? Does she chew your shoes and steal your undies? Guess what? Your dog needs training. Hi, I'm Rini Premeza, the Jersey Dog Trainer, and I train dogs using only positive-based methods. My services include private training right in your own home. I also offer group puppy kindergarten classes starting at 8 weeks of age and group classes for adolescent and adult dogs beginning at 5 months of age. All group classes are held at Dog Days Camp for Canines, 23 West Main Street, Marlton, New Jersey. For more information, please contact me at 609-280-9338 or on the web at www.jerseydogtrainer.com. Again, that's 609-280-9338. We're on the web at www.jerseydogtrainer.com. Good morning, Dr. Dodman.
Good morning, Rini.
Thanks so much for returning to the doghouse.
My pleasure.
I'm anxious to learn more about phobias that dogs suffer from, but I think it would be helpful if you could define for us what exactly is a phobia.
That's curious because, as a veterinary behaviorist, all my colleagues, and I'm sure a lot of trainers, talk about conditions with the prefix fear. Talk about, for example, fear aggression.
Mm-hmm.
But when I talk to psychiatrists looking for their input into these disturbances, and I say, what kind of fear conditions exist in people, they say, none. Fear is a perfectly normal and reasonable response to a fear-inducing stimulus.
Mm-hmm.
And I say, but what happens, for example, if a dog goes hysterical and is aggressive to strangers? They said, that would be an unreasonable, irrational and excessive fear that we would call a phobia. So the bottom line is that in all the conditions that we prefix with the word fear or regard as fear-related are in fact phobias, and a phobia is an irrational fear which is excessive, and actually sometimes it's affecting life in a negative way.
Very interesting. That helps me a lot, too, when I work with different dogs that do have fears of many, many different things. In your book, The Well-Adjusted Dog, you talk about a Bermuda Triangle of fears. What is that?
Well, it's just one way of thinking about the complex of fears, or perhaps we should be calling them phobias, whether it's an irrational fear of, for example, living things would be one point of the triangle. Living things for a dog would be members of the same species, that is, other dogs, and we all know dogs who have unreasonable fears of all other dogs,
mm-hmm.
and sometimes they have fear of a different species, most often us humans, or we humans,
mm-hmm.
but also sometimes odd things like flying insects or horses or cats or some such.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the animate fear corner of the triangle. But they're also frightened of things that aren't living. So some dogs, well, the largest category here is noise phobia, and perhaps the one that people would think about first would be thunderstorm or storm phobia. But other things that go bang and boom and crash, fireworks notably, but sometimes sonic booms or sometimes even just cans dropping on the floor or some creaking noise or some such. So inanimate phobias, which actually can also include things the dog smells and sometimes other senses are involved, so things they see as well, which are odd, like a vacuum cleaner or some such. And then the third corner or third angle of the triangle point is the situational fears, which includes most notably separation anxiety in the situation of being left alone. So it's the whole gestalt of that environment of being home alone, but also things like visits to the vet's office and riding in the car and such like. So all these three points of the triangle, and like in a triangle, the sides are connected. So the fear of living things, non-living things, and situations are oftentimes linked. So, for example, dogs with thunderstorm phobia quite often have coexistent separation anxiety and vice versa. And dogs who have a fearful personality, who are fearful of people, might also have storm phobia. So they're all kind of linked. And sometimes they have all three, and we call that global fear. If you think of that triangle of fear, and in the center of it, there's this sort of ghostly image of fear floating around. The reason I call it the Bermuda Triangle is once you, as a person or a dog as a dog, is inside the triangle of fear, once you have a fearful condition, you actually never come out. And it's the trainer's job and it's the veterinary behaviorist's job to try and make these fears as tolerable as possible for the dog and the owner.
So, in other words, you are, from what I'm getting from your statement, is that you cannot cure fearful dogs, cure them.
Fears are never unlearned. I mean, we know that, for example, most commonly these days people are talking about that kind of fear called post-traumatic stress in soldiers.
Right.
And you don't forget that event, that awful, hideous thing that happened to you.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't go away. It haunts you. And the best thing you can do is to sort of find ways of coping, whether that is by, changing aspects of your life or sometimes even taking medications. You've got to somehow live and cope with that fear, because fears, once learned, are never forgotten, but they can be buried under new learning.
But they can be triggered again.
They can be re-triggered by a particular smell or a particular sight. I was just listening this morning to a soldier who'd been near a car bomb, and he said for most of his life he was okay walking down the street. But when he saw a car parked in a certain way with the wheels 6 inches out from the curb or pointing in a particular direction, the whole incident from before came seething back, and that's the same as dogs, that if, to say, the first event, as one of the dogs in one of my books was, had an incident that it impressed it in a negative way with a man with a white beard, maybe you can get over your fear of strangers, but then you get someone who looks exactly like that man with a white beard, and off you go again.
Yeah. So can we generalize and say that phobias always develop as a result of some other negative association, or can you be born like this?
You can have a genetic predisposition, and that's been shown in humans, not proven in dogs, but in humans they've done studies with identical twins. And identical twins who are raised in completely different, say, parts of the country and exposed to completely different environments will develop significantly similar phobias, whether it's fear of heights or going over bridges. I mean, they'll have the same fear because it's in their genes. So there is a genetic component. We did one study of thunderstorm phobia in dogs, and we found that over 50% of the dogs who were in the study, which was, the best part of 100 dogs, over 50% were herding breeds. So maybe being of a herding breed mentality, which is a dog who's bred for, not to deliver the sort of fatal blow. I mean, they weren't supposed to kill sheep.
Right.
But they're bred for hesitation. Maybe somehow we've cultivated a more fearful side in those dogs, so they're more prone to these fear conditions. There's a genetic influence right there.
Mm-hmm.
But I have to say, then environment has a very strong influence too. So if you think that your genetics primes you, you can't, for example, be born frightened of thunderstorms. You're born primed for that fear.
Mm-hmm.
But the fear develops when you are exposed to the environmental event. You're susceptible to developing that fear.
It's very difficult for me to picture a border collie or a German shepherd that herds sheep and then a storm comes up and then they get scared to death and runs off. But I suppose that could happen.
But German shepherds are very well represented in the ranks of the phobic dogs and of other fearful conditions like lick granuloma and separation
mm-hmm.
anxiety. I mean, they're definitely a sort of more nervous type of dog. And maybe that wasn't the case in the days that they were actually herding sheep. And maybe it isn't in the more wild type dogs. Perhaps the original sort of German strains
okay.
are different.
Mm-hmm.
But the dogs of today who've become popular and have been, inbred, maybe some of these nervous tendencies have been concentrated up
okay.
that makes the dogs of today are more likely to develop these phobias.
Mm, boy, and also, like you said, the environment plays an important role. So if the dog is lacking a lot in mental stimulation at home and not able to express as genetically born to do, I'm sure that can help, or not help, but actually aggravate the situation or bring it about.
That's true, but the best way to prevent a phobia from developing is in the early stages of life, puppyhood, where learning can be very rapid, the so-called
mm-hmm.
sensitive periods.
Mm-hmm.
So in the 3 to 12 or 14 week window,
mm-hmm.
and again a secondary period of rapid learning in the sort of juvenile period following the socialization period, which is maybe up to 6 months.
Right.
If you were to, first of all, expose a dog to a number of stimuli at a very low level so that it understood that these things just are there and a part of life. Let's say strangers, if you arrange of puppies with all kinds of strangers who you engineer to come in wearing hats and with walking sticks and so on,
mm-hmm.
people with beards and people with deep voices and people who are cheering at a sports game. If you can introduce the dog to these people, in a very graded way with positive associations,
mm-hmm.
that can go a long ways towards preventing a phobia from developing. And at the same time, you have to prevent them from an extremely negative event, like being held high in the air by a man with a beard and a big hat or a baseball cap or something.
Mm-hmm.
That could be scary. So protect them against things that would scare them. Introduce them to the things they're going to have to get used to.
Mm-hmm.
A proper socialization to living things and acclimation to non-living things. And actually, there is a company now who's developed an audio tape of all the kind of sounds that a dog might encounter, not just thunder, but also vacuum cleaners and cars backfiring and whatever. And you can play this tape at a very low level during the socialization period, and I'm sure it will help, although it hasn't actually been proven, but that makes perfect sense from a scientific point of view that would be something that would help to ward off the development of these fears later in life.
Absolutely, and I would be very interested to find out where you would get a sound effects tape like that.
Well,
I think I would hand it out to all my puppies.
I thought the Premier Pet Products people maybe made one, but
I'll check it out. Sounds like a good thing. What about it? I actually spoke with somebody last night who has a 1-year-old Cavalier King Charles Spaniel, and she socialized the dog. She took him to puppy class. She took him even to an 8-week agility class, and the dog was very friendly, very social. And when he turned around 10 months old, his behavior started to change. So part of my advice was to have him medically checked out, make sure there's nothing going on. But this happens where from 6 months on, there may be a change where all that socialization isn't really sticking and nobody can think of any kind of traumatic experience. So is there an answer for that, or something may have happened that nobody would even have guessed that could have happened?
Well, that's possible. But I had a case very similar to that myself, and they came in with a fearful dog, and the fearfulness had developed at 9 months. And I had seen that before as a result of low thyroid, hypothyroidism, in an Afghan
mm-hmm.
litter.
Mm-hmm.
And it turns out that all the ones who suddenly became nervous at 9, 12, or 15 months in a show ring situation all had low thyroid, and when it was corrected, the behavior was definitely helped assuage. But this particular dog didn't have a thyroid issue.
Okay.
And this particular dog, like your Cavalier King Charles, had been fairly extensively socialized. And I asked all kinds of questions about the socialization, and it did seem that they had started early enough, which is 3 weeks,
mm-hmm.
or 2 weeks or 3 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And they seemed to have been pretty active at it. and they didn't seem to. So it was an enigma, you know, a puzzle, that this dog apparently had been properly socialized, had no medical explanation, and yet turned on a dime, like at 9 months, suddenly became fearful. And in that case, I mean, the only other explanation is genetic,
mm-hmm.
Because every behavior that we see, whether it's aggression or fears or compulsive disorder, everything must be either genetic or acquired. They're the only two ways that you can get a behavior. The evidence is that about 60% of input into any behavior is genetic and about 40% is acquired. So maybe in this case, the genetic influence was so strong
mm-hmm.
that it kind of lay there latent and then expressed itself at 9 months. And that is known in other species. So you take birds like ravens, for example, and when they're very young, they'll jump around and peck at anything and have no problems. And all of a sudden, when they're at a certain age, they start to develop suspicion, which is necessary, of course, for their survival. They don't automatically dash into any strange situation. And so there is a time when, you know, it's like a time capsule fear that sort of suddenly is opened and read and understood at a particular age. And around about the time you're saying and the time I notice seems to be that time.
Mm-hmm. That's really interesting, and it sort of confirms a theory that I had. What about dogs that are fine, everything's going well, good socialization again, good experiences, then the dogs are spayed or neutered, and within weeks the dog's behavior changes? Can we attribute that to, like, a traumatic event to that dog that brings out the genetic predisposition?
Well, first of all, that could have been going to happen anyway.
Okay.
You know, so it just so happens that we tend to spay and neuter dogs around sort of 6 months, here, 5, 6, 7 months is
mm-hmm.
typical age.
Right.
As we just discussed, the unraveling of some of these fearful conditions seems to occur around about the same time period. But that isn't always the explanation. I think that a dog who's coasting along, doing well, who goes to the vet office and is intimidated because he's never been, you know, socialized to that particular experience. I mean, he's never been acclimated to that situation.
Right.
He starts to react. I mean, I know because I worked inside vet offices and sort of still do.
Mm-hmm.
When I first started out in anesthesiology here at Tufts, I mean, the way of the world, the veterinary world, is that it's the same in children, as a matter of fact, is that they treat them with kid gloves until such time as they start to react. And if children or dogs start to react and scream and flail, they're physically restrained.
Wow.
That's a pretty ferocious thing to do.
Yeah.
You're now pinned.
Mm-hmm.
You can have a cloth muzzle applied. Your arm is gripped. I mean, as the dog, your pupils are big. You're beginning to salivate and shake. Your heart rate's going up. Your blood pressure's high.
Mm-hmm.
Someone sticks a needle in you. The lights go out. You wake up in this stainless steel cage with a terrible pain, and you go, I don't like this.
Right.
And all of a sudden, just from the behavioral side, you've had a terrible shock, almost a kind of post-traumatic thing,
mm-hmm.
which is why when I was an anesthesiologist, I invented what I call the magic carpet ride, where with a little tiny needle outside the clinic, the dog was given something that it would put it into a la-la land, so
mm-hmm.
they would practically skip into the surgery room,
mm-hmm.
and they'd recover painlessly. And that was my main mission, that modifying behavior that way and assuaging fear so that this trauma did not occur. But also, there are some anesthetics they use that can cause bad, long-lasting effects, certainly in people and possibly in dogs, too. The ones that are called dissociative anesthetics, that are ketamine and teledamine,
mm-hmm.
those drugs, they're like acid.
Oh,
and I think you definitely can have a bad trip on those things, and
mm-hmm.
that can have a reverberating long-term effect as well.
Right.
And finally, you know, you are, for example, in a bitch, removing the ovaries, which are a source of progesterone, which has a calming influence. So it's possible that they're less calm after neutering. The same thing doesn't really apply to castration, but castration generally makes them calmer, removing the source of testosterone, and also to exhibit less objectionable behaviors.
Wow, you've answered so many of my questions. This is wonderful. So suppose you have a multiple dog household, let's say just two dogs, and one dog has been living in the home, has separation anxiety, and the owner figures it's a good idea to go get a puppy so that dog would have company. Can the dog with separation anxiety actually have a negative effect on the new puppy and teach that puppy to be fearful of being alone?
I hate to be dogmatic, if you'll excuse the pun, but I think that the answer to that question is no. because in order to develop separation anxiety, you need to have the nature and nurture experiences that lead up to it. So maybe there are some genetic predispositions toward acquiring fearfulness, mm-hmm. but there certainly are some environmental inputs that go in. At least 50% of dogs have been through shelters and have basically been in the canine school of hard knocks.
Right.
They've lost confidence. They bond to owners. So you could take a confident dog who's had a perfect life and you throw him in with one of these, you know, more dysfunctional dogs, and it's not going to make him dysfunctional. So that's not an issue problem.
Right. Okay. That's great. When you have treated dogs with storm phobias and separation anxiety, at what point would you, as a veterinary behaviorist, recommend drug therapy?
Well, I mean, my good friend Dr. Ian Dunbar, who founded APDT, he says, you know, I don't generally, you know, not never, but he says in the past he has them. He says generally he does not use drug treatments. And so in one radio interview that we were involved in, he said, well, what, you know, the interviewer said, so what do you do for dogs with thunderstorm phobia?
Mm-hmm.
He said, well, that's a difficult case to retrain. And so I send those to the University of California, Davis, where they will receive drug therapy. So you don't have, I mean,
that sounds like Dr. Dunbar.
You know? So the thing is, thunderstorm phobia is severe. It's practically a life-threatening condition because they will, if they're left alone and there's a storm, they will destroy the house, which sometimes is the last straw for the owners.
Right.
Or they'll launch out of a second floor window, ripping through screens and broken glass, falling to the floor, injuring themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And then they'll run and run and run into the next town, possibly getting hit by a car or causing an accident. I mean, it's a really serious condition.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're not going to get very far with a dog like that with a clicker training and a bag of treats.
Thank you for saying that, because it's an impossible situation.
We have several measures that we take, and one of them is to try and provide a safe house, just like, you know, people in the Midwest have to do for hurricanes passing through, tornadoes.
Right.
You know, they all have a safe room. We provide a safe room that has, you know, windows blocked off and has white noise in it, and we go down there with the dog and we introduce them. Some of the dogs, they get the hang of it, so they know when there's a storm, I go down there. They'll take themselves off down there where they are not frightened because they know that the storm won't get them down there. And we also use various jackets and coats, like the Storm Defender, which is an anti-static cape. We're just doing an experiment right now on the anxiety wrap, and there's another one called Thunder Shirt, so these things might help. We engage counter conditioning, doing pleasant things during the storm, and drowning out all the noise and drowning out the light with bright lights and so on. In addition to that, oftentimes, just during the storm season, we will have to use some medicine as well.
Mm-hmm.
And the background medicine is typically something like Prozac, which is generally a mood stabilizer. But for the actual event, if there's a storm right above, still that might not hold the dog. So we need a sort of an as-needed medicine. And these days we're using one called Clonidine.
What is it called?
Clonidine.
Clonidine, okay.
It's a human blood pressure lowering medicine, trade name Catapress with a C.
Mm-hmm.
And people take it twice a day if their blood pressure is running a little high,
mm-hmm.
which a storm-phobic dog blood pressure will be during a storm.
Right.
So right before the storm, we give them the Catapress. That reduces the flow of the neurohormones, or new neurotransmitters that cause anxiety, particularly norepinephrine. It just sort of turns the spigot, you know, reduces the flow of these fight-or-flight hormones that are raging in this condition, just turns the faucet down, reduces the flow so the dog can calmly go through it, and 3 or 4 hours later, the dog emerges having, and the storm's passed.
Wow, that's incredible. With the three products that you mentioned, the Storm Cape,
the Storm Defender,
the anxiety wrap, and the Thunder Shirt. What is your early findings on that? Do you feel that that's a good investment to make by getting, and are any of those different from the other? Can you get either or?
We've done studies which we've published on the Storm Defender, and it does produce about a 70% improvement in dogs over, I think it was 3 storms. They don't all respond to it, but I say 2/3 of dogs respond pretty well. It is true that the placebo cape, that's the one without the silver lining, also produces some improvement. It's like a 35 to 40% improvement. And when you do stats on it, because we had a low number of dogs in the study, there was not a significant difference, but there was definitely a trending difference that the Thunder Shirt on its own worked well and was doing better than placebo. So we think that's a good investment. And then we're doing the studies right now on the anxiety wrap, so we don't have any results, but there's some good science. I did a study with Temple Grandin one time on what we call lateral side pressure in pigs, and it releases endorphins, which are feel-good chemicals. So there is some reason why that might work, and we hope to have positive results there. And we haven't tested the Thunder Shirt, but that would be working on the same principle.
Oh, that's wonderful, and I can't wait to get the results of your tests because, I mean, I meet dogs like this all the time, and we're always looking for good products and natural products, and you know, and we know that sending the dog for drugs is not the optimal thing to do unless it's absolutely a really severe case. Very quickly, I wanted to find out, where can people contact you? If, let's say, they have a major emotional disorder that includes these phobias, can they contact you if their own vet is not aware of how to really deal with that part of it?
Yes, we have a service here, and my secretary is also my appointment secretary and assistant. Her name is Ronnie, and she has a phone number, 508-887-4640.
All right.
And if there's somebody who has a question, they just call Ronnie, or they can email her.
All right.
Her email is Ronnie, R-O-N-N-I, dot Tinker, T-I-N-K-E-R, at Tufts, T-U-F-T-S, dot E-D-U.
All right.
Ronnie will help people. And if the person says, my vet doesn't know anything about clonidine, he'd like to know, we have a service called VetFax, where we consult directly with the vet. And we send them special forms. They fill them in about the animal, the dog or the cat. They send the forms back to us, and we peruse all over them and browse through them. And we send back a customized response with any handouts, and we make ourselves available to that vet for telephone follow-up.
Excellent, excellent.
If it's an owner who wants to contact us directly, I'm not allowed to consult one-to-one with an owner because the American Veterinary Medical Association does not let me treat patients where I haven't actually seen them.
Okay.
Like a doctor, you know, a doctor cannot treat you when he hasn't seen you.
Right.
So I'm not allowed to treat dog. But just for behavioral advice, we do have a certified applied animal behaviorist, an associate variety on staff, and she jet drafts responses directly with owners whose dogs have behavioral issues and at least gives them some first aid advice and makes suggestions and recommendations. So that's called the PetFax service.
All right, wonderful. Very, very quickly, you're doing a seminar in Tinton Falls, New Jersey, on Saturday, June 19th, and on Sunday, June 20th.
Right.
Can you just give us a little overview?
Well, at the Tinton Falls meeting, a two-day dog event, I'm talking about everything that all canine behavior, basically, aggression of various types, so-called dominance, what was formerly called dominance, the argument about that, fear aggression, separation anxiety, thunderstorm phobia, compulsive disorders, medical conditions that masquerade as behavioral problems, drug treatments, and a talk called The Well-Adjusted Dog, which is basically a personal version of my book.
Which I'm reading now, by the way, and I really am enjoying it.
So if people want to know more about it or want to read the program in detail, they can go to my website, which is thepetdocs.com. It's all one word, thepetdocs.com. Click on the heading Events, and you'll be able to see the contents there, and actually there's a button you can click on to sign up if you want to go.
Wonderful. I can't thank you enough for providing all this wonderful and valuable information to us. I'm looking forward to meeting you in Tinton Falls. I'm going to be there with flying colors. And I'm going to try to schedule another interview with you because you're a valuable educator, and I would love to share you with my listeners if you wouldn't mind. And so we can be in touch soon.
Absolutely.
I hope you have
you'll love Tinton Falls. The Purr and Pooch, where it's being held, is a very high-end and beautiful-looking training and rehab center for dogs.
Wonderful. I can't wait. Dr. Dodman, you have a wonderful day, and we'll be in touch soon.
Thanks, Renee.
Thank you.
Take care.
You too. Thank you, listeners, for listening today. Please be sure to tune in next week, next Thursday from 10 to 10:30. I'll be talking with the South Jersey representative from an organization called Puppies Behind Bars. Wait till you hear all the great work prisoners are doing for dogs these days. Have a great week, everyone. Talk to you next week.